Victorian joke.
My presentation will be threefold in the sense that it's going to be personal, it's going to be philosophical, and it's going to be artistic. So without further ado, you start by saying, I truly consider this a great honor of being selected to give the keynote on this, the first of what will be an annual event, a tradition, initiated by the Malcolm X Work Group of honoring and perpetuating the legacy of one of the most outstanding persons in the decade of the 60s, Malcolm X. Now, if you're wondering why I consider this such an honor, you must know that Malcolm X, more than any other person I know, was responsible for the development of my Afrocentric mode of thinking, and that phrase can be readily translated into thinking black. The first time I saw and heard Malcolm was at Cornell University in the early 60s, and in one speech, this man crystallized for me all the fragmented idea black. The first time I saw and heard Malcolm was at Cornell University in the early 60s, and in one speech, this man crystallized for me all the fragmented ideas and vacillating feelings about being black in America. He crystallized it into a social and political construct that left no doubt as to who were the victims, who were the oppressors, and that racism is an integral part of the root system of America's liberty tree. In that speech that evening, his wit and genius inspired and energized me and gave me unconditional strength to be able to look white corporate America dead in the eye and respond to its shenanigans with a political analysis as to why there is oppression based on race, class, and later, I added, sex and heterosexism. And I was fascinated with the spirited confidence with which he fielded questions from the audience. I left that auditorium that evening feeling very proud. I can still generate that feeling just thinking about it, how I felt. There were three of us, three blacks, and a sea of white. White students, white faculty. All of us were filled with pride. And in addition to those feelings, I had that sense of growth that comes from newly acquired knowledge that has real meaning. And since that initial exposure to Malcolm, every future contact was an additional learning experience. For example, on one occasion, I distinctly remember him saying with regard to questions, quote, deal with the intent of the question, not just the well-phrased words. And that has helped me deal on many occasions with questions from racist whites and from feminists, white feminists. When I refer to the fact that Malcolm influenced my Afrocentric conceptual thought, and I use the term thinking black, well, that simple phrase is absolutely critical. I consider it the kernel of black liberation theory. Because without this consciousness, an individual is like a fortress with no weaponry for battle. It looks the part, has the right label, but is relatively meaningless and definitely harmless. Thinking black is not something new. It embodies African epistemology, which is that branch of philosophy that deals with the origin of knowledge, the methods and limits of knowledge, or more simply put, how we know what we know. We have been given messages and information about how to think black ever since there have been black people. For example, W. E. Du Bois told us that African American people have to become wed to truth to dwell above the veil. He was talking about thinking black. Johari Amini says that we have to develop a new concept of what is and what is not. That is thinking black. Lerone Bennett says we have to develop a radical reevaluation about our ideas of history. That too is thinking black. Malika Yosante has said we have to look out from our own center through our own Afrocentric eyes. And that is thinking black. And Wade Noble, the black psychiatrist, said We must overcome conceptual incarceration. That too is thinking black. Thinking black is applying an Afrocentric or African orientation to reality that is rooted in a history, a reality that is informed by history and is informed by an understanding of the surface as well as the deep structure of African culture. It is of utmost importance that blacks internalize Afrocentric thought, and Malcolm must be credited for providing blacks in America with the political and spiritual ammunition that enabled them to become confident, be self-assured, to develop a black consciousness. A black consciousness that prepared, primed, geared, and provided them with a foundation for fighting for our liberation with a dignified, perspicacious righteousness. That was one of Malcolm's greatest contributions to the black liberation movement, and it did not go unnoticed. His ability to empower blacks was a critical move, part of his contribution. This was part of the reason he was considered so dangerous. There were other reasons, of course, such as the white power guy's fear and hatred of black male leadership that is unmanageable. But this particular black consciousness, this reawakening, was a recognizable potential explosive. Now, it's been over 22 years since I experienced that reawakening, but the memories are still very much alive. Malcolm remains a role model, a major source of inspiration, motivation, and confidence. A confidence in knowing that I have the correct politics for fighting for the spiritual and economic and social liberation of the oppressed. Correct in my determination to put an end to the might, greed, and brutally exploitative methods of our oppressors. During his lifetime of 40 years, Malcolm received no foundation grants nor invitations to ceremonial awards at the White House. But his memory is cherished more than most other black leaders in history. He met the emotional needs of black folks. On a personal level, his inspiration and influence has enabled me to instill in others the roots, the foundation of black thought, the need for black struggle, and to never let the black spirit become dormant. Now, so enamored was I by Malcolm that what I consider to be two of the greatest compliments ever paid me occurred on these two occasions. One, I'd given a lecture at a college. The woman came over to me and said how much she enjoyed my talk, especially the question and answer period. Then she said, "You know, you sounded just like a female Malcolm X." Well, that made my day. On another occasion, a student told me, midway through one of those student-faculty confabs, he said, "You know, Gloria," this is one of those advanced guard colleges that we call professors by the first name. He said, "You know, Gloria, you and Malcolm are the only two people I know that can insult a person and get away with it. Make it sound like you're giving them an important lesson. You say it with a smile and with some humor, but if anyone else said that, the same thing would be an insult." Now, this also made me feel wonderful. Now, this occurred in the late 60s after Malcolm's death, and my students were well informed about him. However, in those days, I did not speak of Malcolm in terms of African epistemology. I was too busy preaching the word and fighting for the cause. But over the years, I have come to realize the extent to which Malcolm's conceptual messages had been suppressed by the politics of the Eurocentric masculine knowledge validation process. That is, black knowledge being validated by Eurocentric masculine thought and criteria, which is based on their white experiences. Malcolm's Afrocentric style, his behavior, his thoughts, was in one sense unfathomable to the white male-dominated media. They were unable to understand, comprehend, and therefore incapable of appreciating and valuing the man. Indeed, some intuitive and fear and hatred of black male leadership that could not be manipulated also contributed to their evaluation. But I think it is very important to recognize and discuss those specific Afrocentric qualities that due to ignorance on the part of the media were misinterpreted and used to discredit him. And even today, there are those writers who insist upon using Eurocentric masculine knowledge claims for validation of Malcolm, and they construct behavioral theories based on white cultural values. Now, Chandra Mohanty is a sociologist, and she wrote a paper on primitive epistemology. And in this paper, she describes four criteria used by Afro-Americans in evaluating knowledge claims from a black point of view. I told you my talk would be the personal, philosophical, and artistic. This is the philosophical part. In evaluating knowledge claims from a black point of view, these are the characteristics. One, the use of dialogue in assessing knowledge claims. Two, the centrality of personal expressiveness. Three, the ethic of personal accountability. Four, concrete experience as a criterion of meaning. Now, I shall demonstrate briefly how Malcolm epitomized these characteristics and hence part of the reason for his popularity among blacks. Now, these are simply criteria blacks use in determining whether or not a person knows what he's talking about, and if so, whether or not he'll accept him. First is the use of dialogue in assessing how we know what we know. Contemporary Afro-American communities place a high value on the spoken word. There's a call and response discourse made among Afro-Americans. It's composed of spontaneous verbal and nonverbal interaction between speaker and listener. Geneva Smitherman points out, quote, "We are talking about an interactive network in which the fundamental requirement is the active participation of all individuals." End of quote. Now, this is best illustrated, as we all know, in traditional black churches. Now, Malcolm and his audience also exemplified this. The claps, the amen corners, the laughter, the shouts of encouragement, expression of pleasure. This all validates spoken word. For ideas to be tested and validated, all parties must be engaged in the process. Now, if you just sit there and disagree and say nothing, that's considered cheating. This connectedness rather than separation is an essential component in the process of validation of black leaders and followers. A second characteristic is the centrality of personal expressiveness. Black culture allows its members considerably greater freedom to assert and express themselves than of white culture. Black culture values individual, regulated self-assertion. It also values spontaneous expression of feeling. A major component of personal expressiveness is the appropriateness of emotion in dialogue. Rather than judging an emotional speaker as being irrational or out of control, the use of emotions and feeling is seen as an indication of sincerity. And when you see the white press showing pictures of blacks with mouths wide open, supposedly ranting and raving, they take this as an indication of irrationality. It is an attempt to discredit our leaders, and it can be effective. See, they're trying to validate our behavior using their rules. Another component of personal expressiveness is the expectation of personal style or individual uniqueness. Black speakers frequently use rhythms and vocal inflections to convey meaning. The sound of what is being said is just as important as the sense of the words. Both sound and sense are used to deliver the word. The effect achieved is the conveyance of a psychocognitive message. It is nearly impossible to filter out the strictly linguistic, cognitive, abstract meaning from the socio-cultural, psycho-emotive meanings. Malcolm was a master of this phenomenon. For example, when he says in one of his speeches, talking about violence, he says, "So, I don't believe in violence. That's why I want to stop." Now, that is just loaded with sound and sense of the word, and the audience knows what he's saying. We can hear from the way they respond to that. The ethics of personal accountability. only must individuals work out their knowledge claims through dialogue and present those claims in style, proving their concern for their ideas, individuals are expected to assume personal accountability for the knowledge claims they propose or practice or preach. Blacks disagree with the white belief that probing into an individual's personal viewpoint is outside the boundaries of discussion. This is because they feel that all views expressed and actions taken derive from a central set of core beliefs that cannot be other than personal. From this perspective, knowledge claims made by individuals respected for their moral and ethic values will carry more weight than those offered by less respected figures. Elijah Muhammad spoke and preached one brand of morality and practiced another. This was unacceptable to Madison. The final feature of this Afrocentric epistemology is the importance placed on concrete lived experience in assessing knowledge claims. Those individuals who have lived the things they claim to be experts about are more believable and have more credibility than those who have merely experienced them through books or reason that such things must exist. Blacks are quick to ridicule the educated fools who have knowledge but not wisdom. So Malcolm was very believable to all of us who have struggled through racist education systems, have incomes below the poverty level, lived in urban ghettos, been in jail, found religion, hustled, pimped, or self-educated. The charisma, charm, and deep attraction that Malcolm has its roots in African epistemology and African culture. His message experienced them through books or reason that such things must exist. Blacks are quick to ridicule the educated fools who have knowledge but not wisdom. So Malcolm was very believable to all of us who have struggled through racist education systems, have incomes below the poverty level, lived in urban ghettos, been in jail, found religion, hustled, pimped, or self-educated. The charisma, charm, and deep attraction that Malcolm has its roots in African epistemology and African culture. His messages were easily and readily understood by those blacks who did not deny their black culture and those who were able to move beyond the Eurocentric masculinist imposed mode of thinking. Now on February 21st, 1965, Professor Louis Michel of Harlem wrote these words, "Man, if you think Brother Malcolm is dead, you are out of your cotton-picking head. Just get up off your slumbering bed and watch his fighting spirit spread. Every shut eye ain't sleep. You think Brother Malcolm is dead, you are out of your cotton-picking head. Just get up off your slumbering bed and watch his fighting spirit spread. Every shut eye ain't sleep. Every goodbye ain't home." The spirit of Malcolm will never be gone, and to the extent of keeping the man and his deeds alive, I'm in the process of writing an historical novel called On Time and In Step, Malcolm X Meets Sojourner Truth on the Glory Road. Now, the philosophies of both Sojourner Truth and Malcolm X advocate radical solutions that will benefit and serve all of humankind, to the radical problems that oppress and plague humankind. Sojourner and Malcolm are great humanitarians who should be measured by what they accomplish within the framework of their opportunities and should be recognized for their greatness. Their words and deeds made the world take notice. Their impact on and importance to America's socio-political scene should be recorded history, but within the radical, revolutionary, humanitarian framework that it deserves. And I called this morning when James was saying that he was a humanitarian. Now this essay that I am writing serves a purpose. It shows that Sojourner and Malcolm were visionaries. They were outstanding orators and role models, leaders who stood out like giants among their contemporaries as they changed the landscape for blacks and women with their courageous struggle. Carrying out that theme, let's listen in on Malcolm and Sojourner as they stroll along Cloud Boulevard, high above the pollution, untroubled by acid rain and nuclear fallout. This, if you can see, is the artistic page. Okay, I have to shift gears and get into the mode of the boulevard up there. As I write this, in writing this, I also include other late revolutionaries. And so you'll meet several others in addition to Malcolm's journey. Sojourner dressed for the occasion of Malcolm's birthday in a new bonnet, her usual white, but with a black, yellow, and red trim, walked beside Malcolm, two tall figures, a majestic pair, remarkable, fearless, with an arresting dignity. They headed for a cumulus celebration center. Passing the erudite cloud structure of the home of Du Bois prompts Sojourner to say, "Brother Malcolm, another year done passed since your last birthday. And I recall on your last birthday how you replied after Du Bois toast. Son, you got to talking about the Contras in Nicaragua, both in South Africa, and Reagan still in the white folks' house. You got the folks all riled up. So riled up, I thought Chief Joseph, Sitting Bull, and Geronimo were about to bring out their peace pipes. And Brother Paul Rolston was sitting next to Gandhi and Mahalia Jackson, who had journeyed all the way over from Pacifist Paradise." They're not in the Revolutionary Quarters there. They're in Pacifist Paradise. "And Rolston and Mahalia start singing in an upbeat duet to get the party spirit going again. And they start singing one of Bob Marley's 'Don't Worry About a Thing,' 'Three Little Birds,' 'Everything's Gonna Be All Right.' And Mahalia was trying to justify singing a Bob Marley song by saying that he was basically religious." you know, he had an experience, this is a side, that after she was very ill, when she came, well, she said she'd never sing anything but religious gospel songs, so she had to justify saying every good thing to Bob Marley song, I think. Malcolm gave his characteristic grin and said, "Sister Sojourner, I remember talking about the Contras last year, and look what's happened this year. The United States is supposed to be back in Iraq in the war between Iraq and Iran. Now listen to this. They are supporting Iraq, selling arms to Iran, to get money to illegally send to the Contras. But a few days ago, Iraq fires on one of their ships. Now sister, you are a woman of great reason. Please explain that to me." Without waiting for an answer, Malcolm continued, "And as far as Boca in South Africa, blacks still vocal, still being put in detention at the will of the beast. Yes, Boca is a beast, and I can define him by any definition, Boca is a beast. And he, in his re-election speech, he's emphasizing political segregation, and Nelson Mandela is still in jail. Since last year in May, things are escalating. The wrong things are escalating, like lies, weapons, violence, and racism." Sojourner paused, faced Malcolm, and responded, "Seems to me that every time there's so much escalation, you should look around for some desperation. And you will see that escalation comes from both sides, and the desperation comes from both sides. Those doing the escalating and those being escalated upon. But you know, I've been up here since 1883, some 104 years, and this racism still seems to be running out of control. Used to be lynchings, now they use guns. And it seems like both citizens and lawmen called police can shoot down whoever they want, like that white man shooting four 19-year-old black youths. Between the Klan, the cops, and the citizens, it may not be lynching, but death is still death. But Malcolm, let us try to make this a joyful birthday celebration. Sojourner, my sister Sojourner, this year I have an idea that I'm going to let you in on. Sister Ella Baker, one of our latest arrivals, and I were talking about this newly formed Malcolm X work group. They're holding a conference today." Sojourner said, "Yes, I'm mighty glad to have Ella on board. I always did want to ask her about her revolutionary patience with all those young black SNCC workers, sitting through all those long meetings, listening and strategizing. Now what about this meeting today? Well, I figured it would be my birthday treat to have a ringside seat and see how this particular group of mortals are celebrating my birthday. Jerry says, how are you so sure it's going to be a treat? You know, nowadays down there, they got this thing called a roast rather than a toast. And they say all sorts of foolishness about a person, digging up old secrets and talking about people's shortcomings and behavior in a way that sounds disrespectful to me. Malcolm gave Sojourner's study a little pause and was about to answer when a hearty chorus of birthday greetings, brother, interrupted him. There in front of Caribbean Corners was Maurice Bishop, Nanny the Maroon, Fireburn Mary, and Walter Rodney. The quartet exchanged pleasantries with Malcolm and Sojourner and promised to join them later at the celebration. Malcolm continued his conversation with Sojourner. Sister, those are some serious scholars in that group. Sojourner countered by saying, seriousness don't mean righteousness, nor correctness. Clan men are serious. and many of them, like feminist writers, are serious. And in my opinion, most of what they write isn't fitting for black women. How are you so sure all the people in the work group are righteous? I don't want this birthday party to turn into you giving a tirade against those workers. Sister Sojourner, that's a good reason for us to look in and listen. Malcolm, too, was spruced up for the day. He departed somewhat from his usual conservative dress by wearing one of those Caribbean shirts with three embroidery stripes down the front. And he had a fresh haircut, which was almost that flat top look that was popularized by that
Carl Lewis.
As they strolled along the boulevard, they passed a bank of full-blown azaleas, which graced the entrance to the Insurgent Sisters' domain. Lorraine Hansberry and Fanny Lou Hamer, who were tending the flowers, stopped and said there, good morning. Fanny Lou said, well, birthday brother, we were planning a floral arrangement for your celebration, and we were wishing we could send some of these sweet-smelling flowers to that garbage barge with 3,000 tons of garbage that's floating all over the world. You know, it's a shame for any country to have that much garbage. Malcolm said, see, America having a garbage problem with garbage is nothing new. And Fanny, flowers on top of garbage can hide the garbage, but it don't change the garbage. And even if it smells sweet, it is still garbage. Sweet-smelling garbage has been a trick of America for years. Camouflaging is dirt. That barge of garbage is symbolic of the rot, trash, deceit, and conjuration, I got that word from Nanny, that the United States has been peddling and imposing on other countries for years. But nowadays, the other countries are waking up. They are not taking any more of America's garbage. They are saying, no, sir, America, take your garbage right back home. And I'm warning all those little nations, particularly in the Caribbean ones, watch out, don't continue to be the dumping ground for America. Lorraine Hansberry joined in by saying, I think that baby Doc Marcos and Boca should be given seats of honor on that barge. They're as undesirable as the garbage. Yep, and all three of those puppets are in Boca's case, supported by the United States. I've been telling folks that the roots of American politics are so contaminated that we need a new root system. American politics are like foot and mouth disease, have to kill the host to protect the pure. Sojourner intervened by saying, Brother Malcolm, what time is that conference that we are supposed to be looking in on? What conference, asked Fanny Lou Hamer. Malcolm said, well, that's what we're going to see about. Suppose that's something to do with my being born, and I want to check out those so-called scholars. So, they continue to the viewing room, which is the most popular class. The viewing room is especially designed to allow the revolutionaries to beam in on whatever events they desire. Where's this conference taking place, Brother Malcolm? In the city, he replied. What city? There's quite a few of them, you know. New York City, sister. You New Yorkers think that theater. Well, that's where all the action used to be. Sojourner says, seems to me that there's pretty much action in Atlanta these days. Sister Sojourner, didn't you just remind me to make this a joyful day? Yes, brother. So let's take the service shuttle to the New York City area. We don't want to be late. What time do you say this conference is starting? Oh, it started this morning, but we can see a rerun. You know, with this high-tech business, we can record events. So the two boarded the Cirrus shuttle and traveled to a section of the viewing room that beamed in directly on the city of New York. They settled in their seats. Malcolm said, "Now let's see what these mortals are going to say now that Sister Gloria has finished."